Hello, everyone. This is Greg, your host of Goddamn GameCube, and this is Season 4. Follow Goddamn GameCube on social for updates on the show, and subscribe to us on YouTube for bonus video content. Thank you, and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Goddamn GameCube. My name is Greg. I am your host today. My co-host is Riley, and my friend John is back, and we are continuing our Bioshock discussion with Bioshock 2. Riley, why don't you go for it? Let's just get right into it.
Yes, absolutely. So this was a, like the first game, another FPS developed instead now by 2K Marin and the developer Arkane. Published by 2K Games in 2010. It was originally 2009, I think, got pushed back a little bit. We spoke with our dear friend Bill about this, and he mentioned that he felt bitter rage at the inability to work on Bioshock 2. His words, a lot of great things they did with it. The story and the world I'm not as into. As a designer, I would have done differently, but they did a great job and they made a great game. So, from what I gather, I watched some interviews. The team that worked on this at least seems conscious of the pressures of making a sequel to such a beloved game as Bioshock. They felt that, which is kind of interesting, we felt that it wouldn't be Bioshock without Rapture. So that was kind of, you know, let's just get back into it. And something they brought up that I thought was very kind of hit me in a different way was they said, the thing about Rapture is that you've got an entire society of people in an underwater city that's leaking and you can't leave. And I was just like, dude, I was like, you really would have to be crazy to sign up for this.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
So I was going to ask, did any of you know, like, I don't know quite the history. Did the team at Irrational, did they not want to make Bioshock 2, or did 2K not even give them the choice? Like, why did another developer even make it?
I think because they wanted to do something, this is totally off the top of my head, but I think because they wanted to do something different, maybe a little more ambitious, and They said, we need like a Bioshock sequel, you know, like,
okay,
like let's get it done. And so, yeah, I thought that was a pretty interesting way to frame it. What they did was the team actually played through the original game together and, you know, thought about what did we, you know, not get to, cause there was some overlap in staff. What did we not get to do last time? And they just sort of discussed amongst themselves what they felt worked and what didn't. And, you know, for better or worse, I think this is a exceptional idea when you're making a sequel to something or anything like that, like kind of just have a group. Let's just like go through the thing and let's talk about it. I thought that was a great process. So, you know, setting is the same as last time. You're back in Rapture, set 8 years after the first game in 1968 in the long since destroyed remnants of Rapture, which is now controlled by a psychiatrist and ex-missionary called Sophia Lamb. And her philosophy is collectivist, which exists sort of in direct contrast with Andrew Ryan's objectivist perspective, wherein we're all part of a family. We all, you know, part of like one organism. We all sort of contribute. The first batch of little sisters is now grown up, whoever got left behind, I guess. And they have now become big sisters who answer to Sophia directly. They are responsible for kidnapping young girls along the coast to become the next generation of little sisters to continue sort of the atom harvesting process and keep things moving. I had a really odd kind of memory of this when the game came out because as I suspected, the big sister was originally a singular character. My memory is a little unclear, but they were changed to plural big sisters, because you occasionally in this game, you have boss encounters with them.
Mm-hmm.
And this was to give you a bigger sense of victory after you defeat her. For me personally, I consider this to be a downgrade of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think the concept of a rival or hunter presence in a video game is often very valuable. We've talked about, you know, Mr. X, of course, mm-hmm. from Resident Evil. It makes your relationship with the character more impactful. And it would be sort of an interesting twist to have survival be a victory all its own to me, mm-hmm. instead of just defeating, you know, like the big daddies. The main character is now Subject Delta, who is the first successful big daddy to be paired with a little sister, who is originally Lamb's own daughter, Eleanor. Using a hypnotized plasmid, Lamb forces Delta to shoot himself at the beginning of the game. And he is revived via a nearby Vita chamber that has been rekeyed to his genetic code, so you mm-hmm. can use them again in this game.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I think 10 years passed, right? Doesn't it start in 1958?
It starts right before around the revolution, and then, you know, you wake up in a Vita chamber years and
years
later.
It like briefly starts before BioShock 1, then goes 10 years later to where BioShock 1 has already taken place.
Correct.
I think. Okay.
What's interesting is you don't really get a ton of closure with Tenenbaum at the end of BioShock 1.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes back here and gets in touch with Subject Delta over the radio and pretty much explains that if he wants to survive, he needs to preserve his bond and return to Sophia's daughter, Eleanor, because if they get too far apart, the big daddy will die.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they kind of condition them, I guess, at this point. So right off the bat, we talked at great length about the introduction to the first game. What did you feel at the beginning? Did this get you back into it at all?
My opinion is, my brain goes towards no.
Okay.
Here's why. I mean, it could just be personally, I am a sucker for everyman characters.
Right.
So, you know, whether you're talking about Jack from the first game, you know, you're James Sunderland's of Silent Hill. So you're everyman sort of dude. When I saw that I'm going to be playing as a big daddy and I'm the shit, I'm like, doesn't really do it for me. I don't know, John, if you feel, I just feel like I tend to trend a little bit negative.
Yeah, one thing I mentioned in the last podcast was every step of the way in BioShock 1, every story beat was filled as creatively as possible. And I just don't feel the same way here.
Right.
The beginning to me feels really simple and really direct.
I feel like it almost could have used one of those like plane crash sequences that made, you know, the first one pop for people, you know? Like,
yeah.
For me personally, I think that's what it was. It was just kind of uneven footing to start with, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like, at least, you know, that is something different. You know, that playing as a big daddy is different than playing as an everyman.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a completely identical experience.
And it's interesting too that it's the early version of the big daddy,
right?
So
there's some things that you're better at than the others, and some maybe you're falling behind. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit challenging. But in terms of the look and sound and feel, I wanted to talk about this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The aesthetic remains mostly the same as it did in the previous game. There is a little bit more sort of overgrowth after 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Nature is kind of taking back. It's even the logo is a little kind of, you see some barnacles cropping up and stuff. But I did think that the new areas, the new enemies, and the concepts did look great, at least.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of a pervasive butterfly motif going on in terms of you see them sometimes, and there's a lot of murals depicting them, sort of as a motif representing like rebirth, transformation, that kind of thing. What I did like a lot about this game was the brief moments of respite where you walk along the ocean floor.
Yeah.
Sort of a welcome change of pace, and it's kind of interesting to me. It always feels like whenever I get into a big city, it feels limiting if you can only be inside the buildings. Like, you know, you want to be Spider-Man and swing around outside. So you're kind of for once exploring the outside of the city, the geometry around that, which I thought was great. And another great thing about it is that sort of the peaceful atmosphere of it contrasts the claustrophobic rapture interiors, and it sort of reinforces about how aberrant or unnatural rapture is, and by extension humanity at their worst, can be, you know, sort of drawing that contrast with nature. The character models are a lot better this time. They're fully rendered. You know, have normal, sane characters you can converse with. There is a really excellent sound design, a more sort of blues-inspired soundtrack at times, sort of emphasizing this is a lot of sort of the underbelly of Rapture in this game, some of the working poor. I would say that the new voice performances are fairly unmemorable and remarkable, but it is nice to hear some of the old ones again. You get a lot new Andrew Ryan tapes and Atlas tapes and Tenenbaum, all your favorites. I did appreciate that about it. In terms of mechanics and features, I think this is going to be the bulk of our discussion here. It's definitely, I think, where most of the emphasis was put. Focus was placed specifically on improving the shooting segments and adding a little bit more sophistication to the AI in terms of seeking cover, throwing grenades at you. There is now a dedicated melee button, which is very welcome, and the ability to wield weapons and plasmids simultaneously is, I think, totally changes the game. I think it feels like, oh, this is what it's like dual wielding in Halo. It's like, oh, this was always, you know, the future, I guess. There is a overhauled weapon palette for the new protagonist. You have the classic Big Daddy drill, which is a lot of fun to use. You can do the charge and like whack people with it. You can, you have the rivet gun, which is sounds great. Very cool sound design on that. The spear gun as sort of a, you know, even more deadly crossbow. And one other notable thing I wanted to mention was I thought this was a great improvement was the hacking tool, the remote dart. And it, instead of having that series of tubes from the previous game, it's just kind of like you have to time. It's like the Gears of War, like active reload. That's like, that's fine for me, because if you're going to be doing it like a ton of times, you might as well make it like a, you know, just something a little more manageable. And it's kind of easier to adjust like the difficulty that way too. In terms of overall experience, pretty much the same. There is a flashlight built into your suit now, which is nice. It kind of pops on and off automatically. So let me open up the floor a bit here. What did you think of these new weapons? There are finite upgrades this time, so I'm curious which ones you felt were worth upgrading. Did you like hacking better in this game or the previous one?
So I'll start. I found interesting about BioShock 2 gameplay wise. So it's obvious there's an emphasis on the shooting being improved. And yeah. BioShock 1, we didn't really mention it, but the shooting is a little derpy. It's not bad by any means. And I think in 2 it is tighter. I think the balancing in 2 is a little bit better. So you get this weird kind of contrast where you're playing as a big daddy, you're the shit. You have the drill, you have a ton of weapons, but the game is actually harder.
Yep.
Which I found, you know, you're fighting, you know, whether it's big sisters, other big daddy prototypes and stuff too. So I actually think from a, it's tough to say where like, did you welcome that you kind of are playing as a character who is kind of armed to the teeth, or did you prefer to play as Jack where you're kind of vulnerable? Hard to say. I don't really know.
I think in terms of, In how it immerses you in the world, Jack is better, but in a sheer like moment to moment, I feel like Big Daddy 2. Big Daddy 2 is superior in terms of the moment to moment. I think it's a lot more fun moment to moment to play it like that.
John, do you have any takes on gameplay?
Yeah, I agree that it was a lot tighter. I like that you can dual wield the plasmids and the guns at the same time, but I think have the courage of your convictions. If we're going to be a big daddy, we should feel badass.
Yeah.
And it's such a weird thing to say, I want to make BioShock 2 harder than BioShock 1. It's going to take more shots for enemies to go down.
Sure.
But you're the most badass character.
It's and a little odd.
One of those glass cannons. I found that weird.
Yeah, or at least give me a period of time where I'm mowing through people.
Yeah, I think occasionally you got that, but I did feel like these guys shouldn't be posing any threat at all. You're awesome. But I did like also how they overhauled the plasmids in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Each plasmid has been expanded to include new functionality for each upgrade tier. It's something that I felt, you know, you mentioned it's the balancing. I felt this could be very easily unbalanced, but I never felt like too challenged or not challenged enough. It was like a pretty consistent curve throughout the game. You are sort of, when you do this, you're rewarded for experimenting and creativity, which is, I think, pretty fundamental to the BioShock experience. Your elemental plasmids, I'm getting back into the phasmids here, like electricity, fire, and ice, they have charge ups at +2, and they have like streams, like beams at +3. Mm. The cyclone trap can be combined with pretty much anything. At +3, they can be changed to being placed on walls and ceilings. Your decoy one now will reflect damage at +2 and give health back to you when attacked at +3. If insect swarm kills an enemy at +3, it will spawn a new swarm out of their body. So that's kind of, you know, a little bit of upgrade on that one we felt was underutilized last time. Telekinesis at +3 will allow you to throw small enemies around. Mm-hmm. So everything is kind of giving you a little bit more visceral incentive to, you know, upgrade and think about these things instead of just moving the numbers around, you know?
I do remember watching the flamethrower shoot out of my hand in BioShock 2, and I thought that was pretty darn
pretty cool.
And I also think that dual wielding also makes plasmids more viable because you don't have to put your weapon away to pull out magic.
Right.
It felt a little weird in the first game.
Well, you know, zap 'em and whack 'em is no longer a know, it's a very smooth motion.
It's now a simultaneous feature,
right?
Yeah.
And lastly, the scout is a new power that allows you to turn into like an invisible like ghost, like kind of like a drone mode, I guess. And the ghost can hack things and use plasmids, that kind of stuff. Pretty cool. So in terms of this, like, do you have any memories of what your sort of preferences were when it comes to weapons and plasmids and what you played around with in this game?
I remember doing a lot of shocking and drilling. I remember. I just thought it was so, they could have spurred you to do this on purpose. I think in one of the introductory cinematics, your character is literally drilling someone. So I said, I want to fucking do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Always feels great.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you obviously never used it in the previous game. And I thought they nailed the feel of it. That's what it would feel like to lace through somebody. Some of the new enemies I wanted to mention, there are the Brute Splicers now. They're like just big, Left 4 Dead kind of guys. Yeah. we mentioned the Big Daddies. There was actually one that didn't make the cut in the first game that's introduced in this one, called the Rumbler in this one. And it like shoots, I guess, grenades at you. It's kind of like a support role. And you fight other Alpha Series Big Daddies, which are kind of you.
Do you know what's cool, actually? They let you do the drill charge like the daddies can do to you in the first game. You can do the charge.
Yeah.
Yep.
They know that. Mm-hmm. And there is kind of a little bit of a cooldown on it, so you can't abuse it.
Yep.
And as we mentioned, the Big Sister is, those can lead to some pretty tense encounters where you have to sort of plan, you know, like your traps and whatnot and prepare for that. There is now an option to adopt a little sister and help her gather Adam either before harvesting or rescuing her this time, which, I mean, it kind of more or less replicates. I mentioned the Proving Grounds where you have to protect her in the previous game. It is kind of attacking the moral quandary of the little sisters from a different angle. And it's like, so, you know, considering you're a big daddy to begin with, it feels a little bit more like a personal betrayal. But I did feel like it was still kind of tough for me. Like I have really very few reasons to harvest a little sister in this game.
I think they tried to make it more difficult in order to save them. You had to protect them for longer. And so they were challenging the player. If you just harvest them, you'll get the Adam quickly.
Right. Yeah. And you can get more out of it because they can harvest it from the dead splicers' bodies if you protect them. Mm-hmm. Something that kind of bugged me was that you are no longer able to fast travel back to previously visited levels. It is a pretty short game to begin with, and that makes it feel even shorter because I think BioShock games in general are pretty rewarding to explore. So let's say you're like, you know, you're following your compass or whatever under the impression that you can go back later and explore, and you can't. You know, that's kind of a bummer. At the time this came out, I think I was just very burnt out on how many of my favorite games were also introducing multiplayer.
Yeah.
Sort of as a means of cultivating a wider audience. To me, I still feel this way, even though I've seen some behind the scenes stuff and they seem pretty into it. This just to me felt like sort of a waste of resources when the result was an abbreviated single player experience. I very clearly noticed how, you know, I had already been burned by Halo 3 being so much shorter a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, nah, not this one too. Like, yeah.
This game has got to be one of the most tacked on multiplayers I've ever seen.
Yes.
Like, and listen, this game is probably, it's better than I thought it could have been as a whole.
Yeah.
But we're in the era, this is 2010, right?
Yeah.
We're in the era of games where now, I've talked about this theory on the show, and it hasn't come up in a while.
Yep.
Where Call of Duty 4 ruined video games.
It had the exact same structure.
Well, what I mean is now every game has to have multiplayer because Call of Duty is the biggest game in the world.
Yeah.
And but BioShock 2 multiplayer didn't draw more players in. I played it for 10 minutes and put it down.
Yep.
Like, I don't know. I don't know. It's one of the, it's that tough era of games, your 2010, 2012, where everything had, quote unquote, had to have multiplayer. And I think this was a casualty.
I think so. I just wanted to kind of just sum it up in terms of what I meant by the comparison. Like, it has like a prestige kind of mode, like you level up your character and stuff. I like that there is sort of a framework where it's set during the Rapture Civil War and you have your character has their own little apartment and stuff. And it does seem like a good amount of effort was put into it. I just think it was like misplaced.
Yeah, me too.
There are some fun characters I forgot about. Like one of the splicers is a housewife who thinks, because you can play as a Big Daddy in this mode too. There's one of the characters is a housewife who, when the Big Daddy appears, she'll think it's the escaped family dog. I'm like, man, these people are more shot than I thought.
Yeah.
Like, that's a pretty big confusion. There is somewhat of a, you know, creative sense of game mode ideas, like capturing the little sister, and like a juggernaut mode where you get like the Big Daddy armor and you can like mess other people up. But yeah, like you said, I played it for like 10 minutes and just never went back to it. I just don't think it was worthwhile.
I don't think so either.
So with that said, I'd like to get into the story of this one.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if you know this, but like we were saying with the intro, the first level that they had planned was cut out altogether at some point and replaced by the opening cutscene. It would have featured the Kashmir restaurant, the Welcome to Rapture level from the first game, but before the collapse. So it was all like pristine and beautiful looking. And I thought that would have been pretty cool as an effective intro, like a little flashback. A lot of these levels came about from brainstorming new types of locations that would be fun to explore and fight in. The first kind of one you're exploring is the Adonis Luxury Resort, sort of an intriguing first locale because it's the source of Rapture's Vita Chambers. That's where they made them. And I thought that was fascinating because I was like, this doesn't make sense. You have to be related to Andrew Ryan to use these. And this is like the factory. So it's like, oh, so they were tuning them here. You know, like that's that makes a little bit more sense than I was expecting. I liked a lot the Atlantic Express, the train. It's, you know, trains are awesome to begin with. And you put them underwater. Like, come on. Pretty cool. And it's sort of cool that the game progresses along like the railway line of point to point. Great design. There is sort of a weird handoff here, though, because like I said, Tenenbaum starts out helping you in the beginning of the game. And at this point, she takes off and you never see her again. And I was like, wait, like, what? So she's, I don't know, like, what the motive was behind that. But for me, it was like, so she leaves you with this guy, Augustus Sinclair. I think he met you. You mentioned that the original accent for Atlas was a Southern accent, and this guy has one, so you're kind of repurposing that concept.
Mm-hmm.
I think you see, like, Sinclair stores in the first game, so that's something.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, they scrapped the Southern accent in the first one because audiences thought untrustworthy.
Right.
And this guy with his Southern accent actually is trustworthy.
Yeah.
So they were messing around a little
bit of irony there.
Yeah.
They play along with that a little bit, but For me, I was trying to put into words like what this reminded me of, and it reminded me of like when your friend gets you a job and they're you know, they're with you for the first 45 minutes or whatever, and they say, look, I gotta go do something, but I'm gonna circle back with you at lunch, and they never do.
Right.
Like, yeah. Oh my god, I'm right. So sorry, like it's all piled up. But yeah, I thought that was kind of an odd thing there.
Well, she never returns.
She never returns, no. So to speak. So Sinclair is he's sort of a likable con man character, and he previously worked for Andrew Ryan to undermine and arrest Sophia Lamb. So over the course of the game, it becomes clear that he himself plans to take control of Rapture from Lamb, cannibalize its technology, and sell it to the surface world, mm-hmm. which is like something, it's a little different for motivation from what we've seen. Mm-hmm. Early on, you get to Ryan Amusements, which I like this level a lot. It's a theme park schemed up by Lamb and Sander Cohen, the art guy, to sort of dissuade young children from dreams of leaving Rapture. It's sort of meant as like a cautionary tale, like this is what awaits you if you reach the surface world. It's all hellish, and it winds up essentially becoming like a Andrew Ryan like propaganda center. Like it's all these like shrines yeah. of him and everything. It's I thought it was pretty creative. You get a couple more audio logs out of it, and this kind of sets the stage for why he and Lamb had like a falling out to begin with, as she realized this guy is like so vain, like it's clearly like his motivations are messed up. One of the other areas was the Pauper's Drop. Do you remember this at all?
Yeah.
It's a, originally it's like a maintenance switchyard for the train. But what winds up happening is that it gets turned into like low income housing because it's just like,
yep.
Oh, fuck, people can live down there. It's like this,
oh boy.
You know, and, it was originally sort of going to feature some more noir elements, which to me would have, I asked you if you remembered it, it would have made it a little more memorable if they could maybe leaned into like kind of an aesthetic of mm-hmm. little detective, seedy neighborhood kind of thing. This does sort of introduce another wrinkle into the BioShock morality system here. It involves whether or not you kill the supervisor of this area. Eleanor's caretaker, Grace Holloway.
Yep.
And there's like, I have a pretty funny note here. Delta previously broke her jaw while defending Eleanor, ending her singing career forever. Whatever. I don't know. It just didn't work for me. I was just like, yeah, she's like an okay character. I mean, comparing her to like Steinman and
right.
you know, and Sander Cohen, all these guys. You remember this part?
Yeah, I agree that it's not as deep as anything of BioShock 1, but it is kind of interesting. You have this woman who's a lost soul,
right?
And she was taken in by Lamb, and Lamb grew to trust her so much that she was allowed to take care of Eleanor,
right?
And you come and you steal Eleanor from her, so mm-hmm. she has this rage towards you because this woman who saved my life, I was supposed to take care of her daughter, and you took the daughter from me.
Right.
And you have an interesting choice as a player. Do I allow her to live even though she would have killed me given the chance?
Or, sure.
You know, do I let her?
Yeah, I think it's something that it changes up over the course of the game. And even if this particular moment didn't like work as much as it probably could have for me, it's an interesting wrinkle.
Well, I also feel like it's a video game, so you spare her. Right.
Yeah.
I
mean, well, yeah. if you're a pure, pure-hearted guy like us,
I mean, yeah, I have. We'll. I'm sure this will come up over the course of the episode. I definitely had problems with the morality system in this game because it was just very on the nose,
very clear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Siren Alley is pretty adjacent here. It's like Rapture's sort of red light district, and you have these guys called the Wales Brothers who run it. And one of them is like sort of a mad preacher kind of guy. And I think that's generally a good fit for the likes of Rapture. But it's just kind of, you know, like I said, like Steinman and Sander Cohen, they leave this guy in the dust, you know, like he's, you know, I still remember like some of Sander Cohen's lines, you know, and this guy is just, he's just another piece of the puzzle, you know, for me anyway. I at least liked the temple. Do you remember the temple fight where you're in his like church? It's like kind of like a steam room or something.
I don't remember this.
I don't remember.
No, I don't remember this.
Well, you know, that's why I'm here.
One thing, like, I'll say probably a few times in this episode, there are so many ideas that, like, on paper seem interesting.
Right.
It's a hard thing to explain. In Bioshock 1, there's so many things that are just burned into my head. I can quote lines. I remember set pieces. And I remember, like, before this game came out, oh, I'm going to be able to explore in the sea. And it just wasn't as visually striking as I hoped it would be.
It's not as expansive, for sure.
Yeah, it just...
You know, you get some new areas here. Dionysus Park, somewhat of an interesting history to this one, where it was sort of meant as a safe haven for artists to criticize the uncriticizable, like Andrew Ryan.
Yeah.
And you introduce this character here, Stanley Poole, who is an investigative reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And he eventually gathered enough evidence against Lamb and was rewarded with control of the park. So they kind of shanghaied her after this discovery. Mm-hmm. He is also the one who sold Sophia's daughter Eleanor to the Little Sisters orphanage. She seemingly didn't care, though, because it benefited her research. It's a very kind of like character defining moment where you think she's going to be like shocked and outraged, and she's like, oh no, let's see where it goes. You know?
Oh my God.
It's pretty bleak.
Mm-hmm.
But something that struck out in my mind was how I mentioned in the previous game, like the little sister, big daddy fights were all optional. This area, they are mandatory. They're like the main objective. And I'm like, you guys just, this one was phoned in, huh?
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
If you have like, that's all you got. And you eventually meet up with this guy, Stanley, and he reveals that you were once a diver who was exploring and found Rapture. And you were initially welcomed, but eventually became suspected of espionage by Ryan because he's like, all right, you know, I don't trust anybody.
Again, we see his paranoia.
Oh, yeah.
His fear.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. It's a nice moment, and you're kind of turned into the first big daddy. And in this point, you are also given a choice of sparing or killing this guy. But the thing is, what I guess is a little different, this guy probably deserves a little bit more than the last person. You know, he's a pretty hard guy. And that kind of, it continues to change over the course of the game.
Well, that area in particular, if we're talking about Andrew Ryan's paranoia, there's, because what's the word for this? If this area was sort of was Sophia Lamb's, like, almost, what's the word? Where Andrew Ryan tried to create a free society where you can do whatever,
yeah.
But she created art that stood against, like, what he stood for, so he didn't like it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's what they're trying to...
I think that's, like, kind of interesting.
Yeah, it kind of is. Where
Andrew,
like,
Ryan's hypocrisy.
And of course, thank you. That's a good word for it, where you can be as free as you want, unless I don't like it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and I think that's what they were trying to do.
I don't know if you knew this also, but it was supposed to initially be connected to Fort Frolic.
Okay.
You were going to walk through the flooded atrium of Fort Frolic to get there, so implying that Sander Cohen was also, like, in his mind, he was he thought this was a good idea because he has such a free sense of artistic expression. Would have added a little bit more to it.
Yeah, I wanted to throw out something here too, because it's a storytelling thing that I'm thinking about, and it makes me wonder if Irrational Games really wanted to make this game. You find audio diaries of Sophia Lamb having public debates with Andrew Ryan.
Right.
And if something that significant was going on in the city, I feel like I would have heard about it in the first game.
Exactly. Yeah. I was going to bring this up later, actually, but I'm glad you brought it up now, because for me, this whole Lamb thing felt like, pardon my French, but an ass pull.
Yeah.
Like, very much like, wait, who is this person? And I was thinking about how successful it is during, some of my favorite sequels are ones that I don't have any examples to bring to mind where they take, like, a name that was mentioned in the first one and do more with it. You know, like, oh, such and such is a first Spider-Man movie. They say, what's going on with this story? Oh, Eddie Brock's on it. And then he's Venom in the third movie. You know, like, something like that. So, and we mentioned even something minor, Sinclair is mentioned in the first game, and now he's a big part of this one. So yeah, I totally agree with you. It's like, who is this? And
there is a poster in the first game of, like, Rapture's best and brightest,
and she's
Lamb
in
is,
it.
She's in the picture.
Oh, really?
Yep.
But if they were having debates that were literally swaying people in the city,
right,
I think we would have heard about it.
Yeah, completely. I guess in terms of maybe the areas that you were exploring in the first game were more controlled by Ryan and he was erasing the history, maybe. That's an answer. And these are kind of more impoverished people that she was affecting, and you know, her speeches gained traction with them. I guess that's a charitable reading of it, but
yeah, possible.
Getting towards the end here, believe it or not, Fontaine Futuristics is a good level. I don't know if you remember this at all. Very well realized and fleshed out, kind of giving us a better look at plasmid manufacturing, you know, like the consumer side of things, and the extent of the toll it takes on its test subjects through, I don't know if you remember this character, Gilbert Alexander.
No.
Okay, so he presents himself to you as Alex the Great, and essentially excessive atom modification has given him a heavily mutated figure, and he's basically in this big sort of fish tank.
Oh no, yeah, I know exactly. Yeah, yeah, I know exactly.
Fuzzy
who you're
look.
Talking
about. He sounds very when he contacts yep. you. Mm-hmm. His little photo in the radio is just his eye.
Yep.
And he's prone to these kind of manic episodes. And I was looking up, people have like no clipped through it, and you can see his actual form, and it's horrifying.
Oh wow, okay.
It's pretty creepy. But yeah, he's like a total, like he's a complete like mutant. This is sort of also he's very like I mentioned, very unstable.
This is the third moral choice guy.
Yes, yeah, he okay. has a very yeah. kind of he's a multiple personality kind of thing going on. And what it was interesting to me was that this was the result of her experimenting with Jack's mind control plasmid from the first game in a sort of an effort to erode the self and make everyone kind of congeal into one personality.
I was going to say, like, this was Sophia Lamb's great hope. This
right.
person who let go of ego, exactly.
Correct, correct. Yeah. And this is kind of where it gets into supervillain territory for me a little bit, but her ultimate plan is revealed through Adam to transfer the intellect of all of Rapture's greatest minds into her daughter, using her as pretty much a pawn to, instigate her will on the rest of the world. It just doesn't work great for me as far as plans go. It just seems like for a such a human and relatable, even Andrew Ryan is somewhat, you understand his motives, it's very human. This is just like very much like I'm going to take over the world, you know? Like,
yeah. It's like you're really banking on this one specific thing to do this big thing, right?
Yeah.
And it's you know, for me, I think what would have improved it, I had an idea, was that she should have been acting kind of more in Eleanor's best interests as a more understandable corruption of her altruism. Like, you know, so she's like a psychiatrist. She's like, she thinks she understands everybody. And if it would have hit a little harder for me if, you know, she was in essence projecting her own like bullshit onto Eleanor, like, oh, I know what's best for my daughter. I know, you know, it's all about the greater good. You know, I think that would have worked a little bit better as far as motives go. But the way you deal with Alexander here, kind of a good illustration for me about how the morality is like slightly more complicated. I didn't know what to do the first time I played this game.
Yeah.
Where I thought by killing him, I was like putting him out of his misery.
Yep,
I
heard that.
Killing.
And it's like very, very violent. There's like you shock him and there's like blood spraying everywhere. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I screwed that one. I don't know. I guess by letting him live is the correct.
Well, what I've heard about this, I've heard a couple of theories where that in his current state of mind, he does not want to die. So killing him is bad.
Right.
But his previous self would have not wanted this.
Right.
So that's kind of where they're trying to trip you up. Do you take him at his crazed word or do you try to assume what he would have wanted sane?
Right.
That's
right.
Kind of the well, it's a video game, so I spared everyone. But John, did you have a take on this?
Yeah, exactly what you said. And there's audio diaries of him before he goes quite so crazy talking about Lamb and saying, I was her greatest hope and now I'm her greatest disappointment and I'm losing my mind. And I sort of saw it as a mercy killing too. But in its current state, it doesn't want to die. So it's interesting. It's an interesting choice.
Yeah, I thought, you know, maybe a little bit more going on as it went on when you have these like binary choices. And the game, I just want to mention a cute little Easter egg before we leave Fontaine Futuristics. Mm-hmm. They have actually a, it's not injectable, but there is a teleport plasmid here, and you click on it and it keeps warping you to different locations, and you see little scenes here and there in Rapture. And it's just like a cute little reference to the one they couldn't get working in the first game. And it's kind of in the game hinted at, like, this is a work in progress, like, don't right. touch this.
That's kind of right. cool.
So like in Rapture, it's they also couldn't get it working,
right?
Yeah.
Pretty cute.
Yeah.
So the game sort of ends with this prison Persephone, where you meet up finally with Eleanor. And I liked the at least idea of this, of where they had all of these criminals locked up over a like trench, and so they could always like just drop it ever like there's ever a breakout or something like that. Feels very Andrew Ryan in design. There's a really kind of dark scene where Sophia ends up stopping Eleanor's heart briefly by smothering her with a pillow.
Yeah.
To kind of sever your bond, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I did like the sequence here where you have to transfer your consciousness to a little sister. I'm not really sure how it works in universe, but it was pretty cool to see, because you need to siphon Adam from these bodies to proceed, I guess, and you see it through their eyes, so everything is beautiful, and you know, there's the splicers are all perfectly handsome and normal, and
that I think this is probably the coolest part of the game, where you get to see in the eyes of the little sisters everything looks amazing. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like the Silent Hill 2 thing we talked about, where like you're looking through what James wants you to see, and
right.
like the little sisters, you're seeing what they want to see, which is nice.
Yeah, like
they do a cool thing too when they go to get the atom from someone, you snap back to reality a little,
right.
where you actually get a glimpse of what the corpse looks like.
Yes,
I think that's more of for the player's perspective
to
show you their sort of what's the word, their messed up reality. And more
pretty,
for them.
Pretty cool little cinematic moment there, and you see, it's kind of like a museum, and you see there's some statues representing how you dealt with like the people in the beginning.
Yes. Yep.
And you're kind of setting that up. And I thought it was also interesting about this area is that the reason it's directly connected to the plasmid area is that they test them on the inmates from this facility. Kind of a sad part here. You wind up fighting a Sinclair who's turned into a big daddy.
Yep.
At the end, I was like, that's okay, I like
that's
guy.
My guy.
He was all right. And he pretty much like he asks you to kill him, which is even more dark. But I mean we had our problems with the ending of the first game, right? And this for me I think was maybe even worse. The final battle here is sort of this forgettable wave defense sequence, where you're just kind of fending them off. You fight like two big sisters at once or something. And I don't know. It was just kind of, I was going through the motions at that point. There was nothing really special about this sequence for
me. The other thing that's interesting is at the end of the game, you're really supposed to care about the bond between our character and the younger Lamb.
Yeah.
Eleanor Lamb, right. And we haven't had much time of them together.
Right.
They haven't built a relationship. And
correct.
It's one of the biggest emotional beats at the end of the game. And I just wasn't that
working
invested.
Together because she has a big sister suit now and you're kind of, you know, partnering up for this moment.
Right.
And so depending on your actions, Eleanor will either rescue her mother or let her die. And when you kind of escape Rapture like Jack did and reach the surface, and she will either drain your consciousness here, you know, how you bonded with the little sisters before, either sort of like gently or by force, I guess. The ending feels somewhat anticlimactic in the grand scheme of things, but I think handles morality a tiny bit better by tapping into the parent-child relationship here, because your actions sort of set the example for how Eleanor will live her life from here on out. And that worked a little bit better to me when I thought about it more. Because don't get me wrong, like I just walked away from this game the first time going like, well, that kind of sucked. But I'm trying to like find the moments that worked for me in the grand scheme of things. And that was something that I took away from it. Do you have any particular thoughts on the ending?
Yeah, isn't there also specific voice act or specific lines for... She says something like, well, you taught me not to let anything go to waste. And that's like a negative ending, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Not really. Like, I think my big problem with this game as a whole is the moral choices are way too black and white. Like, do you spare or not?
Right.
Like, I mean, it's a video game, so I'm going to spare everyone. Yeah, and I'm going to go for the good guy ending. It's a little bit too much on the nose for me. And of course, if you spare, there is a breakdown of you needing to save at least one person or something. I don't know what the breakdown is, but like, I don't know. It's a little bit too binary for me, as you said, and it doesn't. And what happens at the end of the game, whether she kind of forces I don't know. John, do you have an opinion besides
is kind of where I I kind of said what I had to say. I really thought it would have been so much more effective if there was more of a bond between Eleanor and this big daddy.
Yeah.
I do disagree a little bit. I think some of the decisions you make are a little more gray. You know, are there mercy killings that you make at times?
Or the guy who like maybe deserved to die?
Oh, sorry. I really meant gameplay wise. I wish it wasn't just A and B.
Right.
I wish there was more nuance to what you could do rather than hard yes, hard no.
Yeah.
Instead of prompting you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's different degrees to this ending. There's like good. There's kind of like in the middle. So they're trying.
Yeah. It just wasn't. It's not like A and B.
Yeah.
So I was curious if you minded if I spoiled the DLC here for
sure.
You know, because I don't think either of you have played this one.
Minerva's Den, no.
Yeah. Nope. So this happens. I've played it a couple years ago. It happens at the same time as the events of the main game, and I found this like it's much shorter. Obviously, it's a DLC, but I found it much more effective in its storytelling than the actual game. It is pretty much, you're a different big daddy, subject Sigma, and you are, your objective is to, acquire the codes to something called the Thinker, which is, Rapture's central computer, which kind of governs its, you know, life systems and stuff like that. And it's something I didn't think about, like during the course of the game, it's like, oh, I guess this could have existed because it's very much like kind of that imitation game style of computer. It's very kind of like takes up half a room. And this is actually that like where you finally get payoff with Tenenbaum. She comes back for this and it totally like resolves her character arc and everything. And it's essentially she is trying to use its intelligence to synthesize some cured for the splice population of Rapture.
Oh, got it.
So that's kind of an interesting prompt. And throughout the course of this game, you don't really ask any questions about your origins or anything. Throughout the course of this story, you're assisted by this guy on the radio called Charles Milton Porter. And he is the original architect of the Thinker. And his opposition is this guy called Reed Wall. And he is a basically very similar to the people from the first game. He's a very spliced up like mathematician. And so he's like a genius, but he's clearly like losing his mind. And I thought that was like, okay, this is a little bit closer to what I think of like crazy concept for a splicer. And he's kind of your main antagonist. And essentially, as you progress, you realize he is trying to control the Thinker for himself to be able to predict the future. So I'm like, okay, that's a little bit of an interesting wrinkle. And like, you know, it's not like I want to take over the world. I want to take over Rapture for once, you know? And it is gradually revealed that this guy who's been on the phone with you, Porter, he was using the Thinker to experiment with artificial intelligence and replicate the personality of his deceased wife. So you get sort of this kind of human angle to it. And after you defeat this math splicer guy, it is revealed that you are in fact Charles Milton Porter the whole time. And the voice that you've been hearing is actually the thinker talking to you, synthesizing your own voice to kind of like communicate you with you.
Why wasn't this the main game?
Right. Just like, I don't know. It just it worked for me a lot better. And at the end, Tenenbaum cures you of, you know, your big daddy condition. She gives you your former body back, and it ends with the two of them at his wife's grave. And I'm like,
why wasn't this the
nice
main
little
game?
Story?
Why wasn't this the real thing?
So I assumed, because I had obviously no interest at the time, because I'm like, oh, Bioshock 2, I didn't like that. You know, like I had, and then I played it because it was part of that remaster we were talking about, and I liked it a lot. Hmm. So I think we're going to get into final thoughts here on the overall experience.
Sure.
I was pretty let down by this game at the time, and I think it is vastly inferior to the first game, definitely not without its merits. It's just lacking that sense of newness and mystery the first game had. The shorter length, the weaker characters, and the lack of a major twist like we had in that DLC, for instance, that didn't help it either. I was, if I was trying to sell it to somebody, I would tell them to consider it like a pretty long DLC itself to Bioshock 1.
Yeah.
You know, like it has that kind of feel. There are some strengths and unique ideas in this game where I could see somebody, you know, like there's people who are like everything is like people who like think Dark Souls 2 is the best one.
Oh my
God. I guess like, you know, I can see like some person like gravitating towards a particular element of this game, even though for me, I think, the first one is way, way, way better. I think, in terms of a beginning, middle, and end, the Minerva's Den content is my favorite little self-contained story in this series. Mm. So if either of you ever wind up revisiting, you know, this series in general, even if you skip Bioshock 2, I recommend Minerva's Den for sure.
So John, why don't you take it next? And like always, I'll send us off.
Sounds like a plan to me. This kind of summarizes how I feel about this game. I don't know if you remember, Greg, in high school, I walked into GameStop one day and I saw that Bioshock 2 cost less money than Bioshock 1. And I called you and I was like, that's about right.
Yeah.
That's what it should be.
Yeah.
And maybe the first one just had such an impact on me. I was unnecessarily harsh on the second one, but I just didn't see the same level of inventiveness. I wasn't as excited. I wasn't as pulled into the world. I appreciated that the shooting was made tighter, but I just really don't think Irrational Games, Ken Levine, would have made this decision.
Yeah.
I just don't think that.
Or to include, like, you know, a multiplayer suite to begin with.
My God.
You know?
Yeah.
So for my final thought here, I was trying to make some sort of phrase. I don't know if I'll say it the right way, but I'm going to sort of take what you said and I'm going to build on that. I think even though it is a video game, gameplay does not make a game whole by itself.
Right.
Especially in a game like Bioshock, where a lot of it is just is artistry and aesthetic. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think with Bioshock 2, I don't know what the right word for this is. I don't care that much that it plays better.
Sure.
Like I wasn't really playing Bioshock for the moment to moment gunplay anyway.
Right.
Not really. So I think I was automatically checked out because I don't like playing as characters who are the shit. Like,
right.
I'm a big daddy and I'm awesome. I don't really like that inherently. And the moral choices from a gameplay perspective are very binary. It's very spare or kill.
Yeah.
Not my favorite. I barely remember any characters from this game. I only remember that I had to say yes or no to three of them. And all I remember about Bioshock 2, besides tacked on, like, wow, you really like that one, huh?
Mrs. Yes and Mr. No, my favorite characters.
Yeah, so all I remember is there was a side quest involving like a little kid and a rose or something. And like he was trying to like deliver a rose to his crush, but he died or something before he could get there. Mm. That's all you really get out of this game. So I'll make my summary.
Is this
brief.
Like an audio log or something?
There's literally a physical rose you can find.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Interesting. Is it a rose or is it a teddy bear? It's something like that. The thing about Bioshock 2, I will say this, it is way better than I thought a sequel to Bioshock would be.
Sure. True.
Because this game was not made by the original developers, mostly.
Right.
And whether they made that choice or the publisher forced a different developer to make this, it could have been way worse.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They took the setting, The setting is quote unquote correct.
Yeah.
I definitely, it's one of these games where I think they tried.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
They definitely, this isn't, like we say on the show, I never accuse developers of being lazy.
Yeah.
I think they tried. I don't like tacked on multiplayer, but I think the gameplay is fine. Why don't we say grades and then we'll send it off? So Riley, go ahead.
Actually, why don't you start?
You want me to start?
Yeah.
Nah, C plus.
Sure.
Riley.
Seven? Like same, right?
John.
I'm with Riley, seven.
Seven.
Okay. Yeah, so BioShock 2 is sort of a distinct from
it's okay.
From us here
on
the show.
I hope you enjoy listening to it, even though we were sort of ambivalent.
But, yeah. I think so. Next time we're going to talk about BioShock Infinite, but for now we are signing off, and thank you for listening to Goddamn GameCube.